Yes. Good morning, everyone. I'm opening this Friday, February 22nd, 2013 hearing of the House Committee on Higher Education and Workforce Development. Colleagues, great to see you. Guests, great to have you. We're going to initiate today the first of our Governance Fridays. But before we get there, we have a couple of things that we have to do first. Let me just say, before we get started with today's program, that one of the pleasures of this committee is we get to watch a lot of PowerPoints, right? I know it, you know, really, you get up in the morning and that's really what you're looking forward to, a day of PowerPoints. Yeah. But for the purposes of making things run smoothly, those of you who are bringing PowerPoints, I would ask you to please get them to us by noon the day before. Because we have to, we have a lot of sort of preparatory work to be done of a technical nature. We want things to run smoothly, and so we beg your indulgence. All right, thank you. So with that, I am going to open a public hearing on HCR 9, and it is my distinct honor to welcome my colleague, Representative Lou Frederick, together with Rob Wagner from PCC and the esteemed president of the Cascade campus of Portland Community College, Algie Gatewood.
Thank you, Chair Demereaux and the rest of the committee. Thank you very much. I'm Lou Frederick. I'm a state representative from District 43. That's Northeast Portland, Lloyd Center, and Cascade campus of PCC as well. That's in the district. Concordia. When I came to Portland 39 years ago, Harold Williams was already a force in the community when I arrived. His official public service goes back to the Straub administration. Some of you don't remember who the Straub administration was, but he was back. He worked then as the Affirmative Action Director and Equal Opportunity Coordinator. Now, others are going to list his extensive service in state and city government and higher education, as well as his leadership in many, many nonprofits, advocacy groups, and advisory groups. He was a member of the Portland Community College Board from 1990 until his death last year. And I will defer to the representatives from PCC to tell more of his story. But I do want to say that he was a towering figure. He was a towering figure both physically, but also within the community. He was a person people went to immediately to get information about what was going on and how to best be effective when you got in front of folks and when you got a chance to do something. He was an amazing guy, and I was lucky enough to call him a friend of mine. So, refer to you folks.
Morning, Chair Demereaux, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Rob Wagner, representing Portland Community College. I'll keep my testimony very brief in order to turn it over to Dr. Algie Gatewood, the president of the Cascade campus of Portland Community College. But I will say it's a rare opportunity to be able to start a Friday morning on a celebratory note, although maybe a slightly somber one. PCC is a large district. We are the largest academic institution in Oregon with over 94,000 students and over 1.4 million voters from five counties that stretch from Banks in the south all the way up through Newburgh, all the way out to Vernonia, Rainier and Columbia County, and then all the way up to outer southeast Portland. And in that large district, sometimes it takes a larger-than-life personality to serve. Director Harold Williams was one of those larger-than-life individuals. From humble roots in Texarkana, Texas, to Portland's Jefferson High School, from Salem working with the Straub administration, to Zagreb, Yugoslavia, I would say that faith and service were at his core. On March 4th, 18 members of Director Williams' family will be down here for what PCC is honoring as Harold Williams Day. And we are looking forward to having this resolution, should this committee find favorably upon it. And the family will be here in the side aisles and in the gallery, as well as representatives from North and Northeast Portland and from Columbia County, which were the areas in which Director Williams served, to celebrate his 22 years of service to PCC and his legacy of service to Oregon. And with that, I'll turn it over to Dr. Algie Gatewood.
Thank you. Representative Dimbro, members of the committee, thank you so much for allowing me to speak to you this morning. I also want to thank Representative Lou Frederick and Representative Dimbro for really bringing this bill forward. And my name is Dr. Algie Gatewood, and I'm president of Portland Community College Cascade Campus. I would like to take just a few minutes to talk about my good friend, Mr. Harold Williams, Sr. Working with Mr. Williams has been one of the highlights of my career. Over the course of more than three decades in higher education, I have never known anyone with such a high level of commitment to the people of his community. Mr. Williams was nothing short of an icon in Portland and in this state. He served the state as the state's first affirmative action director under Governor Bob Schraub, as Oregon's labor relations manager, and as the longest serving board member in the history of Portland Community College. As you heard earlier, he served from 1990 to 2012. He helped guide the college through an unprecedented period of growth and technological changes and to a record enrollment of 94,000 students. As a community leader and educational activist, Mr. Williams was admired and respected by all. One of the things I liked best about him was his forthright language and intellectual honesty. There was never any doubt about where Mr. Williams stood on the issues, never. As an advocate for the transformation power of education, he was without peer. He understood quite clearly the critical role that Portland Community College and Cascade Campus play and how education can lift the people up and make them more than the sum of their parts. This vision, as well as his dedication to the community, made Mr. Williams an instrumental part of the evolution of Cascade Campus into the fully comprehensive campus that it is today. Because of his tireless efforts and his ability to build consensus and support in the community, Cascade Campus has grown to more than 24,000 students per year. And with the most diverse student body in the Portland Community College District, the campus mirrors the neighborhood he loves so dearly. Mr. Williams, and I will always refer to him as Mr. Williams, because he was a strong believer in addressing people with respect. Mr. Williams was a graduate of Jefferson High School, and from the time I stepped foot onto the campus in 2004, he urged me to work closely with Jefferson High School and to do everything possible to help more students make that transition from high school to college. With his support and encouragement, we went on to establish the Middle College Partnership with Jefferson High School and Portland Public Schools, which now ensures that every single high school student at Jefferson will graduate with college credits under their belts. Moreover, through the Middle College Scholarship Bank, each of them has the opportunity to earn a bachelor's degree at little or no cost. In closing, let me say that Mr. Harold Williams, Sr. was a dedicated and respected leader, a steadfast champion of education, and a committed visionary in terms of his participation on the PCC Board of Directors. He leaves behind an indelible legacy in Portland Community College, the city of Portland, and the state of Oregon itself. In his memory, I urge you to support HCR 9. Thank you.
Thank you. President Gatewood, colleagues, any questions of the panel? Yes, Representative Gallegos.
I would like to share that actually I knew Harold quite well. I graduated from Jefferson High School and went to high school with Harold, so he's a great man.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Thank you for that, Representative. Yes, I knew Director Williams very, very well, and I think it's very fitting that as we're here today initiating the beginning of our governance conversations for the state, we're going to be talking a lot about boards of directors and what it means to be a good, if not great, director. And so it's really fitting that we have on this day this tribute to really a great person and a good friend for me of mine. I really look forward to paying tribute to Harold on the floor when this comes up on March 4th. So thank you for that, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Yes. With that, I'm going to close the informational hearing on HCR 9, and colleagues, I'm going to open a work session on HCR 9. Vice Chair Huffman.
Chair Dimbrough, I move HCR 9 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Vice Chair Huffman moves HCR 9 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Okay, seeing none, HCR 9 will go to the floor with a be adopted promise. I don't think we need it.
Okay, we're through.
How will it show the vote on the, in the report?
All present.
Mm-hmm. All present? That's how it'll show the vote?
All present voted in the affirmative.
Mm-hmm. Well, then all present didn't vote in the affirmative.
Okay.
He would like to make a motion.
Yeah, would you like to make a motion to reconsider? And I'd be happy to do a roll call vote, Director Greenlee, I'm sorry. Representative Greenlee.
I think it would be appropriate for us all to go on the record in favor of that motion. I would need to reconsider.
Okay. Representative Greenlee has moved to reconsider the motion. Any discussion? Any objection? Okay. Then let us reconsider. We have moved to reconsider. Now we're going to reconsider, and we are going to do this via a roll call vote. And let's hope it's legal, folks. So, Cassie, would you please call the roll?
Representative Gaines.
Aye.
Representative Gilliam.
Excused.
Representative Forsyth.
Aye.
Representative Greenlee.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Yes.
Representative Wisnett.
Aye.
Vice Chair Harker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Huffman.
Aye.
Chair Dembrough.
Aye. Okay, the measure carries. I'm going to have Representative Frederick carry this. Okay, so with that, I will close the work session on HCR 9. And colleagues, I'm going to open a work session on HB 2621. This is the bill that we discussed last week on the use of pesticides on college campuses. Any discussion of HB 2621? Okay, seeing none. Cassie, would you call the roll, please?
We need a motion.
Oh, we actually need a motion. Yeah, okay. Vice Chair Huffman?
Chair Dimbrough, I move HB 2621 to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Huffman moves House Bill 2621 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Okay. Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll, please.
Representative Gaines?
Yes.
Representative Gilliam?
Excused.
Representative Forsyth?
Aye.
Representative Greenlee?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Yes.
Representative Wisnett?
Aye.
Vice Chair Harker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Huffman?
Aye.
Chair Dembrough?
Aye. The motion passes. For this bill, since this is directly related to the viticulture industry, I'm going to assign this to a lover of fine wine, Vice Chair Harker.
Okay. Fine pesticides.
Fine pesticides.
Do we have a pesticide lover who'd like to co-carry? No. Okay, with that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2621. It's now my pleasure to open an informational hearing on Oregon Health Sciences University. The president of that institution, Joe Robertson. Colleagues, this is another step in our Higher Ed 101, today we're going to look at that piece of the jigsaw puzzle located at the hoary heights of Palatine Hill, or whatever hill it is, where OHSU is. The hill. President Robertson. Good morning, Chair Dembro, members of the committee. It's a great privilege to be here this morning and talk about a topic that's obviously near and dear to my heart, that's OHSU. I want to take this opportunity as well to thank all of you for your efforts, I know in challenging times, to work toward the goal of utilizing the resources of the state in the best possible manner to educate the citizenry. We look forward to working with you. And we don't like to talk about OHSU on being on the Hill anymore. We like to consider that it's the state of Oregon, all 96,000 square miles is our campus. So, this is the shortest, the shortest summary that I've ever given of OHSU. There's seven substantive slides here. That's roughly one for every 2,000 employees. So I will try and make it quick, and then leave plenty of time for questions. I think, as all of you know, this is Oregon's major academic health center. We have four schools. We have numerous institutes and centers as well. But the schools of nursing, dentistry, a joint school with OSU in pharmacy, and the School of Medicine. We have roughly 4,000 students and learners. There's also a very large health system comprised of two consolidated hospitals. There's an adult unit and a children's unit, the Dornbecker Children's Hospital. We have a very large and growing research mission, one that has continued to grow despite stable funding at the NIH. Each year we have been successful in getting an ever-increasing amount of that NIH pie. We're the largest employer in Portland. We generate $4 million of economic activity, $2 billion of which is non-replicable, which would go away if OHSU were to suddenly vanish from wherever its site might be. And again, we stress our statewide presence as noted in this slide. This slide happens to pertain to our many of our student rotations, both for the medical students, other learners, and our residents, but we could show you a similar slide for our research and clinical missions as well. And it's noted in the lower right-hand corner, half or more of our patients come from outside the metropolitan region. As I think all of you are aware, OHSU is a nonprofit public corporation. This was established by the legislature in 1985. I'm proud to say that we have the best enabling legislation of any major public academic health center in the country. Senate Bill 2 has allowed us the great flexibility that we have needed to move in a very competitive marketplace. Our board of directors has 10 members. I think, as you will see in the slide here, how they're designated. The important thing about, I think, the composition is of our board, it is not a constituency-based board. Every member of our board has the obligation to represent all of the citizens of this great state. We are committed to coordinating with the other institutions in the state in all of our academic programs where it's appropriate. This is the proverbial pie chart showing the various sources of our revenue. The big green slice here is obviously the one that sticks out. That green slice represents the revenues from the clinical enterprise, and since we are talking predominantly about education this morning, it's of note to observe that $100 million from that clinical enterprise is brought over the transom to support the academic missions of our institution. We have approximately, it's a technicality when we talk about students because of federal definitions of students and who's a student and who's an employee or worker, but we have 4,400 learners. Many of those are fellows, residents, interns. We actually, of note, most people don't realize this, we actually have more graduate students now in our School of Medicine than medical students.
These are some of the collaborative degrees that we work with other institutions. I think you will see this continue to increase in the coming years, and we are looking forward to developing other partnerships as we try to develop the expanding healthcare workforce that will be needed in the era of healthcare reform. And that is my very brief summary. Again, I would welcome any questions from you.
Colleagues.
I have a question.
Yeah, of course, sir.
Many years ago, OHSU had a major role as a mental health care provider in terms of law enforcement emergency holds. Do you still have that role?
Representative Gorsuch, we still play a major role in that capacity, and we serve several distinct populations in the community of those needing mental health services. You've mentioned one. Another is those patients who have significant comorbidities, who have very, very serious medical conditions as well as the mental health needs.
Thank you.
Rep. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. President, the Senate bill that gave OHSU their autonomy, if you will, also called, I think, for the creation of an institutional board, a strategic board. Could you talk a bit just about the role of that strategic board, how it networks with your institution, what kind of form and function they have, and how you as president interact with them?
The OHSU board, Representative Johnson. By that you mean the OHSU board.
Yes, please.
I think as most know, our board, the nine members are nominated by the governor, approved by the, confirmed by the Senate. One of those is a designated position from the OUS board, and the other comes from somewhere in the student population. That board has a fiduciary duty for the overall performance of OHSU. It works very much like a corporate board. The board clearly understands the mission of the university. The board clearly understands the public nature of that university, and manages us in the same manner I think any other corporate board would manage and oversee a large corporation. I am selected by the other nine members. I have the most frequent interactions with the chair of the board, who's responsible for my performance evaluation. I also interact with the board through a set of standing committees that we have. Those committees have no authority to take action. It is only the board itself that can take any action. Those committees are simply advisory to the board. And then we conduct the vast majority of our proceedings in a public forum. We have an exception for those matters pertaining to OHSU that are predominantly in the clinical enterprise that are of a nature that you would not normally give to competitors.
Great, thank you.
Professor Robertson, I want to follow up on that point. And first of all, I want to thank you for keeping your presentation so brief, but also to thank you for your long service to OHSU. You've been the president for a number of years, but you've been associated with that university for many, many years, including the time that it changed from its previous status as part of OUS to a corporation, or a public corporation. And I'm wondering, at the time of that transition, why the decision was made to use a corporate model as opposed to the kind of model that the university model that the State Board of Higher Ed uses.
Chair Dimbrough, yeah, thank you. Yes, I have been at OHSU in one life form or another, starting back in 1979 when I began my training as a resident in ophthalmology. The compelling reasons for the change were related to what was happening in managed care at the time and the need for OHSU to move nimbly and with alacrity in a very competitive marketplace. And that was not only necessary from the contracting and partnership position, but also from a capital budgeting and allocation. And I was there when we actually had the funds, and for 4 years were trying to align everything in Salem to expand our maternity ward. And so, I mean, there were many reasons, and I think there have been many benefits, but it was for, flexibility and speed of execution were the primary drivers.
Okay, thank you. And now I'm going to ask a question that I think I know the answer to, but I look forward to your saying it, and that is OHSU has relatively high tuition relative to other public university hospitals, medical schools. I think I have an idea of what drives that high expense, but I wonder if you could explain to us what the reason for that is.
Chair Dimbrough, we share the concern that all of you have about the cost of tuition, and we have made this one of our major philanthropic goals is to raise money for scholarships. We've actually been fairly successful about that in the past few years. Quite honestly, this is directly proportional to the amount of state support that we do receive. If you look at the funding that if you look at a various pie chart of how, for instance, medical education is funded, you will see that OHSU as an institution provides more to support to every student now than we ever have, okay? And that is taken in terms of whether you use that as inflated dollars or non-inflated dollars. The other commitment that we have made to the state is that during the period of time when the state appropriation has diminished, we have continued to expand the size of all of our health professional classes, and we will continue to do that as we move into the collaborative life sciences building. So we have to go out and actually find the financial support to do that. And finally, often not seen in the statistics that you review, because it is not state funding directly that supports these student learners, we are currently roughly, this is changes month to month, but roughly 176 residents over our cap for the amount of federal funding that we can receive for graduate medical education. And it is the graduate medical education that most closely corresponds with where practitioners ultimately located. That is at a cost to the institution of roughly $14 million.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Rep. Greenberg.
Let me tell a little story. The question which will come at the end. When I was department chair in public health, we created an MD-MPH program. The MD-MPH program was a joint program that could recruit students from around the world and has recruited some very exciting students. Part of the motivation for that was the fact that the legislature kept a tight lid on OHSU in terms of out-of-state students. And I think this was thought by the administration that this would be a way to get another dozen out-of-state students at a higher tuition in. And we all in the university administration knew that there was this tight limit. When the university budget came up, this must be 96 maybe, university budget came up, the Ways and Means Committee, grilling the then president, Dr. Kohler, said, well, why don't you guys just take more out-of-state students? And all of a sudden, the floodgates opened up because whatever had been thought to be a restriction was no longer a restriction. Now, could you comment on the relative balance of in-state and out-of-state students and how it affects your perception of how it affects the future supply of physicians in the state of Oregon, particularly in rural Oregon?
Yes, Representative Greenlick, I would be delighted to do that. We have a goal of, for instance, it's slightly different for each school, but in the School of Medicine, of approaching 80% residents of Oregon in our class. Sometimes it may, you know, you can't hit the number exactly, so it may be in that 75 to 80% range. We do receive more tuition from out-of-state students as we've expanded the size of the medical school class. That's been an important factor. We learned that once you attend or once you participate in the educational process in Oregon, your likelihood of landing in Oregon is the same whether you're a resident or non-resident at the time you either matriculated to medical school or you initiated your training as a resident. We also have a very high percentage. Our capture rate, again, is in the upper quartile, roughly. It's just below that in medical school, just above it in the graduate medical education arena. So we are one of the most effective schools in making sure that our graduates stay here. We're also very effective in sending people into primary care. The most important factor with regard to whether someone practices in rural America, rural Oregon, is whether or not they have a rural heritage. If you have a rural heritage, you are six times more likely to practice in a rural area. So there are people that we actually very actively try and attract to OHSU that are non-Oregon residents that are very interested in practicing in rural, and that they are very drawn to our primary care programs. We also know that without admitting roughly 20% of students from outside the state of Oregon, we will never be able to hit the figures relevant to diversity that we think we need to maintain the diversity at OHSU to instruct our students in treating a diverse patient population.
Mr. Chair, we'll be dealing in the healthcare committee with some overlap in this in terms of loan repayment and rural supply of physicians, and it's useful to have this interaction because it is a problem and there are ways to deal with it. But one thing that, if I'm off that, really makes it hard to get primary care docs is the debt burden of your students, and perhaps you could just talk a little bit about that debt burden because it certainly affects things we talk about here as well as in the healthcare.
Yes, and let me just say that I appreciate that question, and I look forward to the answer. And colleagues, consider today a sort of opening stab at this issue because we will be having, you know, a couple of days down the road where we're focusing on the healthcare workforce and, you know, the needs of Oregon to develop its healthcare workforce. And so it's great to initiate this conversation today. Thanks, Dr. Robinson.
Okay, thank you.
No answer.
I'm not dismissing it.
Excuse me. I have colleagues here.
You tried to escape. It didn't work.
I have colleagues here who are salivating.
It's
I can
so
see
hopeful.
Them.
Okay.
Chair Dembrough, Representative Greenlee, again, the tuition is a burden. That is why not only have we made this a priority with regard to our fundraising, it is also related to one of the policy option packages that we have brought forward. It is something that we are very cognizant about. It is an issue. There are no easy answers. So I mean, but we will in the ensuing weeks. I will find. I do not have it right at my fingertips. The exact amount of money that we have raised, for instance, for scholarships over the past few years, and I think you can tell by that we are earnest in our attempts.
Thank you, Mr. President. Rep. Huffman and then Rep. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Robertson, I know we're running a little short on time, but could you touch a little bit, Representative Greenlee kind of touched on OHSU supplying docs to rural Oregon, but from a different perspective, I know that you've had a collaborative going with Mid-Columbia Medical Center in cardiology, and is that common? Do you do that? Do you do that kind of an outreach collaborative often, and where, if you could touch on it just a bit?
Representative Huffman, Thank you for that opportunity. If you are strategic, it actually all goes back to our strategic plan, and the essence that was which we created in 2007. And the essence of that strategic plan says that OHSU will partner to make Oregon a leader in health and science for the purpose of improving the health and well-being of our citizenry. We take that to heart. We have partnerships, some of which I've alluded to around the state. The particular partnership that you have mentioned is an example of what we can do in the clinical arena. We work with the community. We only go where we're invited in. We are not marauders from the hill. We go, we work with them to develop a community health assessment. We talk to the leaders of the community, the practitioners, the hospital, anybody that wants to talk to us and try and determine how OHSU can best interact with that community to improve the delivery of health there. And you mentioned some of the, we have worked with Mid-Columbia Medical Center. We, one of the unique, I think, aspects of this program is we will jointly recruit physicians. Many physicians would actually like to settle in a rural community, but if they are a specialist, they don't want to settle there because while they like the community in general, they don't feel that they have a professional community. We've jointly recruited these physicians and given them an appointment at OHSU. Sometimes they work 4 days a week in the community, one day at OHSU. We have down in Southern Oregon a radiation oncologist who works about every sixth week at OHSU, and this community was at risk of losing its radiation oncology program. That person participates with grand rounds, comes up, teaches. It also is a wonderful opportunity for us because it gives us non-urban sites to involve in clinical research programs, and we think it's important to have that type of data as we really begin to examine what will and won't work in the area of healthcare transformation.
Great. Thanks.
Thanks, Dr. Robertson. Cliff Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for President Robertson. We also wanted to point out that he enjoys a second home in the beautiful Columbia River Gorge that's just barely outside of my district and resides in Representative Huffman's district.
It's kind of mine.
Yeah. My question is related to a topic that I hope we'll take on intensely in this committee, and that's cost drivers. We know that throughout public education, the cost drivers are they're impacting negatively both access and affordability for students and so forth. OHSU has taken some proactive action to try to get a handle on some of those cost drivers regarding your personnel and benefits and so forth. Could you just kind of briefly touch on what action the university's taken and how you think that will help you long-term to be able to rein in those growth and those cost driver areas?
Thank you, Representative Johnson. I believe that specifically you would be referring to the action that we took regarding our retirement program last summer. In the summer of 2012, we incurred an additional $20 million liability for in PERS for the future cost of our retirement program. That was projected to recur again in 2014 as it's reset every 2 years. And as we looked forward, we thought that represented a threat to what we wanted to deliver in with regard to our missions. We have two retirement programs at OHSU. That was the ability to have a second retirement program was part of the enabling legislation that I referenced earlier in 1995. Our second program is UPP. It is a defined contribution program as opposed to PERS, which can be a defined benefit program. Our employees have the option of selecting either plan, and in recent years we've actually seen an ever-increasing number select the UPP plan. What we did, and I'm happy to talk about this at greater length, but we currently pay both the employer and the employee pickup in the PERS program. We also pay 12%, roughly the equivalent to UPP. We said going forward, and we negotiated this in our union in a union contract with AFSCME and then adopted it for the remainder of the employees. We still have a nurses contract that negotiation that is occurring this spring. And we said we will in the future, you can pick either retirement plan because you can make a one-time change from PERS to UPP, but we will continue to pay the 12% for UPP, but we will not pay the employee pickup in PERS. Okay, and that's because the employer portion is roughly, again, at this particular moment, roughly to 12% or soon to be slightly more. We then also arranged a sliding scale, basically that initially there is a boost of 5% given to those individuals that decide to make the transition, and then that diminishes over time. We anticipate that by making the transition in this manner with the normal wage increase that will occur in each year, that at no time will any employee suffer a reduction in their actual take-home pay. Then the employee will have the choice of, because that phases out over 2 to 3 years, of either making a greater contribution or not. If they feel the return in PERS is worth it, they can continue to stay in the program.
Thank you.
Yes. So just to clarify, so there was not a reduction in total compensation for the employees?
No, there was not.
Great, thank you. Thank you very much, President Robertson. Now, I'm not going to let you go just yet. Actually, on the contrary, I'm going to call up President Vival if I can. We're going to be hearing a bill related to the relationship between Portland State and OHSU, and so I thought before we get into that, if you two have anything to say about the partnerships that I know we've heard about before and I assume are ongoing.
Thank you very much, Chair Denborough. For the record, my name is Vim Vival. It's a pleasure to be here again. You're going to be pretty tired of me by the time the session ends, but I thought I should just start with a very brief highlights of PSU. President Robertson did the OHSU 101. I'll make a very brief PSU 101 and then talk a little bit about the work that we've done on the strategic alliance between OHSU and PSU over the last few years and make comments on the proposed legislation. So, as most of you know, Portland State has 29,000, almost 30,000 students. Over the last 4 or 5 years, our funded research activity has grown from about $40 million to $67 million. Admittedly, still just a rounding error in Joe's research, but it's definitely going up there, and a lot of that is joint work that we're undertaking. Our key hallmark as an institution, of course, is that we're deeply engaged with the metropolitan area, with the business community, for instance. A key example of that is that Intel hires more PSU graduates than they hire from any other university. We have over 1,000 PSU alums working at Intel. Deeply engaged with the school system. The key example, perhaps, is the All Hands Raised program, which is the Cradle to Career effort in Multnomah County that we took the initiative on, and that's just been very successful in really creating this whole education pipeline idea in Multnomah County. Deeply engaged with government, doing all kinds of work for the state, for local government, a lot with Multnomah County, especially through our School of Social Work, a lot of evaluation programs, mentoring programs, foster children programs, and with individual community and social service agencies, really too numerous to mention. And a lot of that happens both through our faculty research and the capstone projects that all of our graduating seniors have to engage in as a team with an external organization. Over the last 15 to 20 years, the amount of money that we spent per student to educate the students has remained flat once you adjust it for just the regular consumer price index. It's about $11,500 on average. But as you all know, of course, the price has changed because 20 years ago the state paid about 80% and the student paid about 20%, whereas now the student pays about 70%, the state pays 20%, And if your math is correct, you know that leaves about 10% of a loss. We make that up on volume. Mostly, however, we make that up with the non-resident students who bring in more money. Furthermore, the only way we've been able to keep the actual amount of money, and it's so important because, remember, there's a lot of literature out there talking about, you know, the climbing walls and the facilities and the lazy faculty or the numerous administrators sitting around twiddling their thumbs. No, we spent the same now as we did 20 years ago, and it's in the face of, for instance, hugely increased PERS and PEP costs, increased costs for almost anything else. We've done that, frankly, by shifting more of the educational burden to fixed-term faculty rather than tenure-related faculty. So that means more people who don't do any research, who do more teaching. That then has consequences, how much and the nature of the education. We've also done it by continually pushing hard for administrative efficiencies. Just in the last year, we reduced the number of vice provosts from 5 to 3. We got rid of one whole school, the School of Extended Studies. We have moved most of our administrative activities from applications, financial aid, and all that to an online environment, reducing the amount of staff that we need. We've hugely reduced our energy costs by building a very efficient heat and steam loop, and I could go on for a long time with a lot of other things like that. Right now, we're engaged in what is the most challenging cost reduction effort, which we call Rethink PSU, which is to really think hard about how we restructure the actual educational processes. Those are the core of what we do, of course, but how do we take advantage of the new technologies to really figure out how we can deliver education more efficiently by using technology? And I could talk for a long time just about that, but that's where we really at the core of the institution and continuing to drive down cost so that we can at least keep tuition from rising faster than inflation, or at least not much above that. Right.
Thank you. Mr. President, if you can focus on the relationship with OHSU.
I'm going to do that right now. Thank you. Yes. Our comment is prompted by House Bill 2339, and we want to thank Representative Greenlick for his strong commitment to both of our institutions over many, many years, long predating when President Robertson and I were involved. And I think it's also fair to say that without Dr. Greenlick's encouragement, our partnership would not have progressed to the level that it is today. It's been a tremendous boost. For the past 4 years, we've been engaged in developing much closer ties, and we created a formal strategic alliance, which was the result of the task force that we had after the 2009 legislative session. And that task force at that time, which was asked to look into the possibility of a merger or a strategic alliance, concluded, and I quote, that a strategic alliance could be transformational, leading to higher quality education, more research, greater community engagement, enhanced economic development, and so on. And it pointed out that on the other side, a merger would require significant upfront investment and divert scarce resources and attention from the university's core education and public service missions. So, as you know, and you've heard from our presentations, we are very different institutions, so I don't want to elaborate that. And we've been trying to take advantage of that complementarity to make progress on 12 recommendations that the task force had. And this collaboration is guided by an implementation committee, which is made up of all the vice presidents of both of the institutions, and it's chaired by our respective vice presidents for research. They meet at least quarterly. Individual meetings take place much more often than that. And then they regularly bring President Robertson and me up to date on progress in the areas of academics, research, administration, finance, economic development, and even philanthropy. And if you think that collaboration is fascinating, when you get institutions to work together on philanthropy, you know, that's when you see that we're really making progress. So now turn to President Robertson to give you just a few examples. We're not going to go through everything of the highlights of our collaboration thus far.
And let me say before you start, President Robertson, a couple of us, Vice Chair Harker and I, were on the Education Committee when that initial report was submitted. But we'll get it out to all of you so you can see what that looks like.
Chair Dimbrough, the Collaborative Life Sciences Building, or CLSB as we call it, really is the hallmark. I mean, this is a phoenix that's rising on the south waterfront that is a testimonial to our collaboration. We broke ground in October of 2011, and as we, I think, our administrative teams have spent countless hours working together on what is really going to be a unique building. There is a degree of collaboration between institutions in this building, predominantly between OHSU and PSU, but also with Oregon State, that is unparalleled, I think, anywhere in the country. And for example, our researchers are going to be assigned by the area and topic of the research rather than by who pays their paycheck or what type of institutional badge they wear. It has created the need for shared information systems, and as we've looked forward, has resulted in a coordination of our class schedules. It's been the final motivation to make OHSU get on one academic calendar rather than roughly 13 different academics. So I thank all of you for having helped make that become a reality. The building will contain a state-of-the-art professional simulation center that will be used not only by the individuals from these institutions, but from other organizations across the state. Currently, the CLSB includes approximately 133 square feet of state-of-the-art research, and we have specialized laboratories there led by individuals such as Joe Gray, and at other times, I think you've heard us talk about Dr. Gray, one of the premier cancer researchers in the country, and there's great collaboration between Dr. Gray, OHSU's biomedical engineering, and PSU's computational mathematics department, and others. We have seen marked collaboration between the basic sciences and computer sciences now as they interact with the biological sciences. I think this is very timely. As we move into this next generation of medicine, we are going to see medicine become more and more computational biology, and this partnership and this co-location will greatly facilitate that. I think it's going to be a joy to watch the intermingling of the undergraduate students with the graduate students, and I think that is the ultimate assistance in the pipeline of getting people from to consider health and science professions.
The next area of collaboration that I think is very major and we're very proud of is that right after the Strategic Alliance was formed, we pulled together a group of over 50 faculty members from the two institutions to discuss the goal of creating a joint school of public health. They have now formulated the vision for what that public school of public health should be and how it should be distinct nationwide. And it's called through world-class education, research, and community engagement programs, the School of Public Health will address the social determinants of health that are critical to maintaining health and well-being through the life cycle. So the key things there are the social determinants and the notion of the life cycle. This is not about just taking care of sick people. This is about looking at all aspects of life and community that create healthy life or not. And it fits very much both with the things that OHSU faculty has been doing, our focus on community and institutions of community life. As part of this, the already existing Oregon Masters of Public Health program will truly be a degree that we both grant. We will add new PhD programs, which are required as part of having a School of Public Health. And we're working on a monograph now that describes the health of each county in Oregon, which will very much be a foundation for addressing the research and education efforts of this new School of Public Health. And then we hope to get this formally established and start the accreditation process a year from now.
And I think I, before moving on to the my assigned topic, I just want to say, I want to reiterate the excitement about this Joint School of Public Health. By doing this together, we are going to have a school that I think is significantly better than either one of our institutions could develop alone, and at considerably less expense. It's also given us the opportunity, as President Vivel just said, to really choose the focus. And when we talk about these social determinants of health, 80% of your health care outcomes are actually determined by these social determinants of health. So we and the faculty are really excited about this, the development of this new school. If again, you look at the vast expanse of activities where we collaborate all the way at one end to these professional degree programs, we are working together back at the front end in the STEM program. We each have a commitment in this arena. You've heard me talk about the pipeline before, so this has allowed us to pool our resources. We actually have our provost is coming down here to already scheduled to give testimony next week. I think she will elaborate on this more. The provosts are working very closely in this regard so that we ensure that we have the adequate pipeline from students with all types of diverse backgrounds to move into the health and science fields. Now, we thought it would be worthwhile to just talk or continue to glance into the future and see what is on the horizon for the Alliance. As this alliance matures, we think that more opportunities for collaboration will emerge. To give you an instance of, or an example of the trend, we'll see more shared publications, more research. We are beginning to see this already. Shared publications have increased 28% from 25 publications in 2009 and 2010 to 32 in 2011, and 42 new joint grant applications have been submitted. As this is an activity that just builds upon itself, as the faculty become more familiar, these opportunities will continue to arise. When our faculty are co-located in the CLSB, I think we'll see another step function increase in this amount of academic publication. We have many shared facilities. Some of the cost savings that President Vivel mentioned earlier, our facilities people are working more and more closely together every day. And we think there are economies of scale to take advantage of in that arena. President Vivel and I actually like each other, and we actually spend a fair amount of time talking to each other, and I think that's worth noting. And I mean, the collaboration isn't going to work if that were not the case.
Including spending some recent time in Joe's emergency room.
This is something that we really both do perceive as an opportunity for our institutions, and we think that together we can leverage the resources that each institution has, and we will be more effective in doing that than, as opposed to remaining in isolation. We do have some concerns about the pending legislation, and we would like to express those. As we noted at the beginning.
Actually, President Robertson, why don't you hold off on that?
Okay.
And let me open the public hearing on that so that Representative Greenlick can present it. And so if you two can just stay there. Rep. Greenlick, do you mind not going down to present?
Don't mind at all.
Yeah. Okay, so hold on there. I'm going to close the informational hearing on OHSU. This has all been part of that. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2339. And before we get into that, Victoria, could you just give us the broad overview of what this bill does?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2339 removes Portland State University from the Oregon University system and establishes it as a public corporation under the control of the Portland Metropolitan University's Board of Directors, formerly known as Oregon Health and Science University Board of Directors, declares legislative intent regarding budget and funding of PSU, becomes operative July 1, 2015.
Okay, thank you. Rep. Greenlick, would you like to speak to the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I may for a moment introduce my colleagues a little bit to my background, which is where this came from. For 30 years, I was Vice President of Research for Kaiser Permanente. As a part of that job, I taught at both PSU and OHSU. I was taught a course, a term at PSU for about 25 years, from 1965 or so to the mid-1980s. As a part of doing that, I got the grant for the first PhD program in urban studies at Portland State. I was on the first advisory committee for the Middle East Studies Center program, which has expanded enormously since then. I was very much involved in the development of the part-time faculty union at Portland State. I was on the organizing committee of the AFT. I was very much involved. At the same time, I was also involved as clinical faculty, eventually a clinical professor, at OHSU, teaching regularly in the Department of Public Health and Preventive Medicine. And in 1990, I became the chair of the Department of Public Health and Preventive Medicine and a professor, and served in in that role for a decade, including the time in which I helped to develop the joint Masters of Public Health program between OHSU, PSU, and OSU at that time. So I've been very much involved in these universities in one form or another now for nearly 50 years, going on 45 years, and I've looked very seriously at where I believe these universities need to go, and I think where you're here they're going is a direction that they need to go. I think that's it's going exactly well. But very early in my career in the legislature, I sat at a presentation on the economic health of the metropolitan area of Portland. And one of the barriers that was raised, and it was raised again in the summit a couple of years ago, in the business summit, was that Portland doesn't have a world-class research university. And that Portland, the argument will never emerge until we have a world-class research university to draw the kind of support from the business community that that we really need to create the economic development engine. We're talking about trade clusters and a variety of things, but the fact is, when you look at the world ranking of universities, Portland State is not ranked in the top 500. Montana State is, other things, OHSU is. OSU is somewhere around 300. University of Oregon, somewhere in that same area. Thank you very much. Somewhere in that same area. Psychologically, PSU is viewed as the university in this state is not a world-class research university. It doesn't mean it's not serving its function. It doesn't mean it's not a first-class university in what it does. When it compares itself to universities, it's not to Harvard and Stanford and Yale, it's to universities of its type. So I sat back thinking, how do we create a world-class research university? Well, we could move all three universities, in the three major universities, into Portland and create some new university or something like that, but that's not very likely to happen. Can we start from scratch and create University of Washington, say, or UCLA, starting from scratch? The answer is no. All we can do to create a major research university, which we need eventually, is to bring these two universities together under a label that brings that sense that there is, in fact, a major research university. I believe together, even now, they are serving as a major research university. So my first shot at this, and this has been going on now a few sessions, was to say, okay, let's merge them, and here's a way to merge them. That got into all kinds of problems, like who would be the football mascot? I mean, would you have a a Viking with a white coat and a stethoscope. I mean, it kind of, you know, here's Mitch's crazy idea. You know, what's the next thing? And I'm not kidding. These were the kind of things that were actually raised. The natural development of what's going on now, which came about as a result of their promise to find ways to create a strategic alliance, is moving exactly in the right way. And what 2329, what 2339 does, it does not talk about merging two universities. All it talks about is getting these two partners that are working collaboratively under a single governance structure. And it proposes moving PSU out of the university system, expanding, recreating the board that governs OHSU now into a larger and more powerful board, if you will, and puts both universities as parallel universities under that board. That, it seems to me, I've been, you know, in starting the MPH program, I realized the problems that two governances have. I mean, how do you cross-list classes? How do you deal with the things that you need to do to really facilitate this kind of collaboration? The governance gets in the way. And my belief is eventually these two universities will become a single university. I don't think we need to foreordain that. I mean, I trained at Michigan. Others of us have trained at other places where universities have medical schools. It's just, in fact, President Vival, in his, as I remember in his first speech coming here as a part of the recruitment process to come to Oregon, pointed out that the university he was at, the University of Illinois Chicago campus, wasn't taken seriously until it merged with a medical school. I mean, that's, in a sense, the issue here. But let's not talk about mergers anymore. I would like to consider 2339. I would like to facilitate what I think is going to be inevitably happening, and we have some discussion about this, PSU, OSU, and U of O coming out of the university system in some form, not for education coordination, but for the business functions. This will facilitate that. It will create PSU in the same image that OHSU has been created as a public university under the same kind of governance, and would let them go forward with a single governing body. Now, let me just say, if we don't do 2339 and we do a different model for creating a local university board for PSU, I will submit an amendment to that board to make an expanded OHSU board the local board under whatever conditions we create local boards. I don't think, incidentally, I personally do not think we should create a halfway local board. I think if we're going to local boards, we need to know where that's going, we need to know where the university system's going, and we need to know what the plan for higher education in the Portland metropolitan area is. But I see this as being one of two routes. I would urge us to seriously consider 2339, or to think about it in the context of university governance, but I am really committed to making sure the Portland metropolitan area has a university presence that will foster the development of the region over the next 25 years. So that's where
thank
I am.
Yes, thank you, Rep. Greenlick. I promise you that we will continue, that we will consider, well, certainly we'll consider any amendments that you want to put forth, but that we will also consider the points that you raise as we're looking at the larger governance issues. But now, specifically to the points that you raise, gentlemen, do you have a response?
Chair Dembrough, thank you for this opportunity to comment. And again, thank you, Representative Greenlick, for your motivation and inspiration.
I love you guys.
I think we both share the same aspirations, yeah. And I hope everyone understands that and that we're perfectly clear.
And Dr. Robertson, since we've switched to a public hearing on a bill, could you identify yourself again for the record?
Yes, thank you. I'm Joe Robertson, president of OHSU.
Thank you.
some of our concerns center around circumstances that are inherent to who each organization is, and other concerns center around the specific events of the time. With regard to the former, the constituencies of the institutions are different. I mean, PSU, as President Wiewel just said, is focused on the metropolitan, regional, urban, and is a specific charge to that institution. Our charge is clearly a statewide charge, where we are. It is our mandate to interact with all. So I think, besides the difference in cultures, there is a difference in charge. So with regard to the boards, one of the concerns that I would have at this time, and as I think, if we look back historically, both education and healthcare have been fairly immune to the laws of economics. But the laws of economics are as immutable as the laws of physics. And they're just, the reaction times are just longer. And both are being subjected to those now. And the educational, and again, President Wiewel is better to address this, but the educational paradigms are changing. And healthcare is undergoing, this is radical transformation. We are basically up to our ears in healthcare transformation, and I think we have a mandate from this state to be a leader in healthcare transformation, and we literally have an all hands on deck. Our board is very studious in trying to guide us, you know, through the right course, how we can do the things that we need to do to continue to prosper as an institution, but also serve our statewide mandate. And because of that, what's actually happening around the country, as evidenced at the University of Washington, is those large university boards are creating separate boards to deal. The University of Washington has created University of Washington Medicine Board so that they can develop the expertise to deal with healthcare transformation. There is still a fiduciary duty and a link to the major board, but the recognition for the expertise is that apparent. So I think there is a question, besides the cultural things, and we've mentioned before, I actually think there's a very realistic concern about the bandwidth that would be necessary to do that.
For the record, Ben Vivo, President of Portland State University. And as Representative Greenlee said, coming from University of Illinois at Chicago, I have always been intrigued by this idea. I was there when that merger happened between University of Illinois Chicago Circle, which was an institution very much like Portland State, and University of Illinois Medical Center, which is an institution very much like OHSU. I also noted that merger left a lot of blood on the streets and a lot of pain that still exists. So they're not painless events by any stretch. We've had people look at the nationwide experience, and it's a mixed bag. There are examples of where, in the end, it really did pay off. There are also quite a number of examples of where it utterly failed. They went their own ways again. So the research based on that doesn't really give you a conclusive answer that this is always a good thing or always a bad thing. That's not surprising. More relevant now, I think, is the current moment that we're in, precisely because you can't just go by the national experience. And I very much feel like President Robertson does, that just like this is an unprecedented time of change in healthcare and the financing of healthcare, and therefore takes all the focus of a board, as I alluded to in my earlier comments, it's an unprecedented time of change in higher education specifically. The radical changes in delivery and pedagogy with this rapid growth in online education in a context of rising tuition and rising student debt, which prices potential students out of the market and really makes it impossible to keep going. The public will just not stand for further increases. How to really rethink, as I said, how we do our business is going to take all the attention and focus both of the senior management team and, frankly, of any board that we now hope we will finally get. One of the reasons why we've been a proponent of Portland State getting its own board is because I have felt that the State Board of Higher Education while they're all wonderful and competent individuals, they simply do not have the time to focus on Portland State because they're dealing with seven institutions. I feel that if we have a board that has to focus on this 800-pound gorilla, with all due respect, you know, I'm not sure that we're going to get the time and attention that are needed to help guide us through these very challenging and very rapidly changing times. So that's really the, you know, we can talk a lot longer about it, but that's really the key issue. Give us a chance to get this on board, to really take advantage of that, both for the strategic advice they give, the advocacy they can provide, the deepening of the connections even beyond what we already have with the metropolitan area, to make sure, frankly, that 5 to 10 years from now, we come out of this change with a very strong Portland State, allow us to continue to enhance the strategic collaborations that we have given examples of. And at that point, there may be a time where a different structural arrangement might make sense. But we'd hate to have that huge distraction now instead of focusing on our core business. As a final point, I would make that the dream of this incredibly strong metropolitan research university that's truly a major anchor, with the examples, whether it's Berkeley or UW or any of the others, as we know, there is a minor thing of just a huge funding differences. It's not about the structure. It is, what is the number you used to use, that UW gets somewhere like five times, or, you know, the amount of money, how per student, or however you want to calculate it, that either PSU or OHSU does. That is, I suspect, far more important than the precise structure. So thank you very much for being able to comment on this.
Thank you, gentlemen. Colleagues, any questions for Corsa?
Yeah, for President Wewell. Now, I'm biased. I'm an adjunct there. I'm a graduate of urban studies. But Representative Greenlee gave a rather dim view of Portland State, and I'd just like you to point out some of the really highly regarded schools that are within that rather dimly rated set.
Well, thank you for that opportunity. I do not feel that he gave a dim view, though. So, and I'm sure he would take exception of that too. I know Representative Greenlee is a great fan and supporter of Portland State, and the statements he made were, I think, carefully calibrated. To be fair, it is, until now, it really has been the goal of Portland State to serve the metropolitan area. It is not our goal to become so exclusive, say, that we only accept the best students from around the country and that we are no longer accessible for the people of average ability. We feel that this is what the legislature created us for, to serve broad range of people. As you know, once you have a 3.0 GPA in your high school, you're in to PSU. You don't have to write an essay. You don't have to prove that you've, you know, cured cancer and, you know, solved poverty. We let you in because we think that you deserve an opportunity at higher education. The consequence of that is that all the rankings will never put you up with, you know, a UW or whatever, and we accept it. But we also have been able to provide an absolutely superb education for those who come. One of the first students who was a recipient of the McNair Scholarships of PSU, which is specifically for minority and disadvantaged students, went on, and he came to PSU, I think, in 2004, 2005, just recently received his PhD in physics from Oxford University. Our Honors College, which is now still called an Honors Program, we're going to make it an Honors College, grew by 60% in just the last year and just received $1 million gift. 2 years ago, more of the valedictorians from Multnomah County chose Portland State than any other university. Kathleen Gable, which many of you know, is a very exclusive private school in the Portland metropolitan area. 2 years ago, their number one choice for their graduates was the University of Southern California. Their number two choice was Portland State University. So we are able to provide an absolutely superb education, and people choose us for that reason. And programs like urban planning, social work, our business school, which is worldwide ranked as the highest ranked small MBA program in a publication by the Aspen Institute, Beyond Gray Pinstripes. Anyway, you opened the floodgates. I can see Chair Dembro getting impatient because he knows that I can go off on.
I know you could go on and on, Mr.
Good,
President.
I like that. Yes.
Thank you.
I guess put on the record. I definitely did not intend, or did I think I did, produce a dim view of Portland State. And there are some marvelous programs, which, for example, might be strengthened if the two engineering programs are one engineering program rather than two. I mean, there are a variety of those. I'm simply pointing out, in terms of the view of the world of Portland State, in the context that it says, well, should we go to Austin and form our business there, or how about Boston? Do they have universities in Boston? Okay. How about the Bay Area? Are there any universities down there? I mean, maybe Seattle. There's venture capital reasons to go to these kind of places as well. And they're just not drawn, those people, by the sense of what Portland State does as an institution. You put these two universities together, and in terms of the current world ranking system, they move into the top 100 without any change. Simply putting their faculty, their students, their grants, their awards, they move into the top 100 of world universities simply by the magic of putting it together. That shows that those ratings don't make any sense. But on the other hand, people pay attention to them.
Thank you.
I'd like to, however.
However, notwithstanding.
Portland State is very important in terms of education.
Yeah, you betcha.
Portland State is educating a lot of students. And there is a danger that we go more and more towards research and more away from basic college education. And I don't want to see Portland State do that.
Thank you for that, Rick Gorsuch. So, colleagues, I think I'll close the informational hearing in
Thank
a second.
You, Mr. Chair.
Yes, but I do want to say that, you know, following up on a comment that President Vival said, we may, as we are working our way through this, the language relating to governance, look at perhaps creating a path where if two university boards felt it was in their interest and in the interest of the state to merge, that would be a possibility for them down the road. Or, you know, alternatively, or perhaps concurrently, if there were interest in having overlapping directors. You know, right now OHSU has a State Board of Higher Ed person on their board. You know, perhaps it would make sense to have a Portland State director on their board and vice versa. Those are all things that we can certainly explore as we go through this. So with that, again, thank you very much, gentlemen. And I'm going to close this public hearing on House Bill 2339. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2149.
Okay.
And President Vival, don't go too far.
So you can sit down, but
we'll be calling you back up in a moment. Colleagues, 2149 is what I'm calling our frame legislation with respect to university boards. It came out of a process that was initiated last year by this committee in House Bill 4061, which created a joint committee, joint special committee on university governance. And it included four representatives, two from each party, four senators, two from each party, and two members of the OEIB, the Oregon Education Investment Board, Matt Donegan and Kay Turan, and to explore at length this issue of does it make sense to allow individual universities to have their own boards. We had received requests from Portland State University and from the University of Oregon. And we felt that rather than try to deal with this, certainly during the short session of February, this was an issue that needed time, it needed deliberation, it needed a lot of analysis and looking around the country for different models. So this special committee was created, and we did our work. Jeff Johnson and I were the co-chairs from the House side, and Senator Haas was co-chair from the Senate side. And we met, I think every 2 weeks it seemed, yeah, from mid-April until we filed our final report in October. So that is a kind of background to it, and I'll speak more about it. But let me turn to Rep. Johnson for just some preliminary remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And yeah, it was my privilege to serve as co-chair along with you and Senator Haas on that committee. And, you know, the committee had a pretty daunting task laid out in front of them to try to bring together so many divergent viewpoints about the future of higher ed governance in Oregon. And the topic really came out of both the 2011 and 2012 session, where there was much discussion about what can we do to enable our higher ed system to perhaps be more strategic in helping all of Oregon to achieve the 40-40-20 aspirational goal that we adopted in 2011, and in the opinions of many, providing greater autonomy for governance at the local level within our higher ed system is one of those pathways to that. So we took testimony from a wide variety of folks around the state of Oregon about that topic and so forth. And if you're at all like me, I'm kind of a process guy. If I have confidence in a process, I can have greater acceptability or faith in the results that come out of that process. And I felt that we had a great representation of a multiple different viewpoints on the committee. But when at the end of that process, we came together in not unanimity about everything, but in terms of what you see in the recommendations, there was a very, very strong consensus about where we go forward from here. And we had a very open and frank discussion and dialogue. I think every member spoke freely and openly about their feelings, their concerns, and I think that made for a better outcome. So I feel very good about the process that got us to where we actually have this House bill now to move forward. So obviously there's work left to be done. We didn't finish our work saying that this is the impeccable draft and it should be passed as it is. We anticipate and have a need for multiple amendments, I think, to provide greater clarity and address concerns that not only the committee has, but I think some of those here with us today may have about what ultimately becomes a higher ed governance. But I think we've done our work and laid out a good pathway forward that, again, as we look at this through the idea of what can we do to really as a state achieve the 40-40-20 goal, that really should drive our work, I think, on this committee. What can we do to give our universities the ability to truly get to that next level? Because what we've laid out in front of them and charged them with is a high task. But I do think that the work on this bill will help project that mission forward, and I look forward to the days and multiple, I think, committee sessions to come on this piece of legislation. And I would just say that I hope we take our time and don't feel a sense of urgency and try it, but get it right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Rep. Johnson. And, you know, the charge that the special committee was given was to look at two major areas. One was the question of does it make sense for universities to have institutional boards? And the second was sort of larger issues regarding overall higher education governance in the state and the looking at the potential of board consolidation. And, you know, I think I spoke on our opening day about how, you know, one of the challenges that we have in post-secondary is we have community colleges which have their own board. We have universities that have their own board. We have OSAC, the whole student scholarship and the Student Access Commission function that has its board. And there was a desire, and then we have the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. There was a desire to see if maybe we could have a higher level of coordination by bringing those, you know, those functions together in a better working relationship. Now, that was a task that was, you know, frankly beyond us, you know, in the short time that we had to work on it. We took a stab at it, kind of working closely with Matt Donegan, who's the president of the State Board of Higher Ed and was a member of the special committee, we kind of farmed that one out over to the OEIB and you know, the governor's office to take an initial stab at it.
which they have done, very grateful for. And that is going to be the other big strand that we're going to be following this session. You know, all the issues related to the Department of Post-Secondary Education and Workforce Development and their relationship with the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission. That's a whole other thing that we're going to be working on this session. We made more progress in the question of university boards, although, as Rep. Johnson said, this was a consensus document, and we were not able to reach consensus on everything. So there are still some holes in it, particularly with respect to the question of who sits on the board and how the people are appointed. Shared services among the universities, what we do with those, and some other issues related to relationship with the treasurer with respect to revenue bonds and tuition setting. I think we got pretty close, but there's probably still more work to be done there as well. Anyway, one of the real keys, I think, to ultimate success in the, you know, in this venture is going to be the service, the perspective that we can get from our university presidents, both those that want boards and those that may want boards but I don't know, aren't sure. And so before I go into a little bit more about the principles, the findings that the special committee came up with, since we have President Vival here and President Chris Maples from Oregon Tech, one of the biggies and one of the littlies, no, but someone from a teaching university and Portland State, a large university, I wonder if you could come forward and talk to us about a process that's been going on among the university presidents to try to reach consensus on this issue. And colleagues, let me say, you know what a struggle it is for us all to come to consensus. But that is nothing like the struggle for consensus among our university presidents. So please, gentlemen, introduce yourselves and tell us what's happening.
Thank you, Chair Denbrough. Vim Vival, President of Portland State University. I will make some remarks, and then my colleague, President Maples, will make some remarks, and I'll come back and wrap it up. And indeed, if the process of managing faculty has been compared to, as you know, herding cats, and there I've always said that the way you herd cats is you rattle the food bowl. If you're trying to herd seven presidents and you don't have a football to rattle, it gets really tough. Nevertheless, we have been on top of all the discussions we've, of course, routinely had over the years. We've very intensely, over the last 2 weeks, just been a little over 2 weeks, worked on formulating a set of consensus principles related to the issue of governance. And just as Chair Denbrough said about the work that the task force did, there are certainly areas of disagreement that we have once you get into some of the details, but we've tried to get as close as possible to detail where we still do have consensus. And we're making the final wording change. We'll be sending the final text of this either later today or Monday to the chairs of the relevant committees. So let me hit the highlights for you right now. Starts out very much by saying that the most significant challenge facing us is, in fact, the long-term trend in reduced public funding. And so in many ways, that would be the single best thing that could change that would help us do a better job. And we're very clear that structural changes are not by themselves a solution to the problems we have. And we don't want anybody to think that by changing the structure, you've suddenly magically changed all the problems. But having said that, beyond the funding, the greatest needs are for operating flexibility on the individual campuses and for alignment across multiple institutions, including high schools and community colleges, to achieve the goals of 40-40-20. And therefore, it's essential that any new governance structure provide greater flexibility for the institutions to remain fiscally viable while also remaining accountable to the public. And this will ensure and will enable us to educate more students with greater learning outcomes while containing costs. And based on that, we have formulated seven principles. The first one speaks about collaboration, that all seven of us are committed to work individually and in concert to meet the higher education needs of Oregonians. And we will, regardless of what structure exactly gets established, we will continue to meet regularly as a President's Council, as we now do, to support and enhance that collaboration. The second principle talks about distinction, that any new governance model must acknowledge the characteristics of each institution, our individual missions, histories, cultures, constituency, and geography. And we acknowledge that each university has an interest in maintaining its status and identity as an individual university.
And we've decided to hand off to one another. For the record, Chris Maples, President of Oregon Institute of Technology. And as a segue in from distinction, I would like to remind the committee that for the past decade or more, the seven universities in the higher education system here in Oregon have worked very hard to make sure that there's not replication, overlap, wasting of resources, that we have really tried a portfolio type of effect in which we are delivering what we deliver in the educational realm the best way possible and the most efficient way possible without stepping on each other's toes. And we've worked hard at that, but yet that distinction has to continue as we go. In terms of governance, without getting into great gory detail with regard to all of these principles supporting the 40-40-20 North Star that we go to, I would say that what we collectively have agreed to is that we really want to be able to be involved in the choice, be able to have a voice heard, be able to be involved in a process that provides a level playing field for all of the universities in the system, everyone, with no presaged outcomes in any form or fashion. And that's a really important aspect of what we do. In terms of state funding, I could go on and on and on about some of the data related to state funding in Oregon. We have plummeted from 2006 to 2011. We've become among the least funded university systems in the nation. We've had the highest decrease in state funding, among the highest decreases in state funding in the nation during that time. And we've had the highest percentage increase of students over that same time of any state in the nation. So we are performing at a really high level, all things considered. And our tuition is about middle of the road. So honestly, the state funding aspect, and we are, that's probably the first thing that we all united on, is that need to maintain some state funding and maybe even build on it, to invest in Oregon's economy, to invest in Oregon's future. In terms of coordination, the transparency cannot be overemphasized. We, as public universities and as public university presidents, we're all very used to being accountable to students, to faculty, to Board of Higher Ed, to various outside constituents, and that coordination to ensure the transparency and public accountability and the most effective use of our limited resources is a really important aspect of what we have agreed to do in principle. It's a good thing. It's the reason we're all in public higher ed, both for the egalitarian nature of public higher ed and really for the transparency and the accountability to the public. We are Oregon's public universities. And I'll turn it back up.
And if I may, just to elaborate, one, I think it's worth reading this text on the governance point, in addition to the point that President Maples made about the importance of having each university play a strong role in the discussion about its future, that we also agreed that institutional boards, if they to be formed in whichever way, that they should have the time and expertise to focus on the needs of their respective university or universities, that they should reflect the interests of regional and mission-related stakeholders, Third, that they should support the objectives of the state's 40-40-20 plan. Fourth, that they should increase ownership of the university or universities among constituencies. And fifth, have the statutory authority to govern the institutions, including hiring, firing, and evaluating the president, and that they should provide transparency and public accountability. And on the coordination point, I think it's important to say that we very much support the general direction of the legislative proposal that came out of the task force. You know, obviously there are a lot of aspects and details still to be completed. The sixth principle that we talked about was that related to shared services. That we recognize that economies of scale can be realized by sharing certain administrative services on a voluntary basis, with the possibility of limited exceptions where it would be mandatory. The universities will participate in a cooperative to maximize such economies. And this cooperative could actually eventually include institutions now outside of OUS, such as OHSU or the community colleges. And the seventh principle speaks to operational flexibility, that although statewide coordination is important, the governing boards of Oregon's public universities need significant operating flexibility and governance authority to manage the day-to-day affairs of the universities, including bonding authority, the right to set tuition within certain parameters for resident undergraduates, the ability to establish institutional policies and other similar broad powers in order to achieve maximum efficiencies and effectiveness for the universities and the state. And this has been signed on to by all seven of the presidents. And as I said, we will be getting the final text to you either later today or first thing on Monday. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Presidents. And we look forward to getting that and to perusing it. You know, I think, colleagues, I sent you last night the report from the committee, the special joint committee, so you should have it in your inboxes if you haven't seen it already. And I would really encourage you to look at it, and especially to look at the initial findings of the committee, the principles by which we went into the details in the bill. And I think you'll find them very consistent with what you're hearing today from the presidents. You know, what we found was that there can be value in institutions having local boards for the reasons that we heard earlier from President Vival, that, you know, they're closer to home, they can focus on the institution, they're a place that faculty and students and community can go to directly to address issues related to their universities. There can be real benefits to it. But on the other hand, you know, we don't want to lose the benefits that we currently enjoy by having an articulated system, a coordinated system. And so we're going to have to try to find that sweet spot, you know, where you have local autonomy up to a point, but you're still enjoying the benefits of, you know, a coordinated public university system. And so that's what we're going to be struggling with in both of the bills that we're going to be working on. The one, you know, on our side, it's, you know, we're calling it House Bill 2149. And that's the university board bill. So that one, actually, the Senate has taken a quick lead on through Senate Bill 759. They're working on it over there. I'm hoping to have Senator Haas come before us very soon to let us know, talk to us about what's going on the other side of the building. On the issue of the departmental, the new larger governance configuration, our committee is taking the lead on that. And we're currently, LC is drafting an initial draft for us. You know, I've asked that be ready for us by March 8th, we will then have that initial draft that we can start to work on. In the meantime, we're also putting together a kind of high-level stakeholder work group to give us advice on, you know, what it means to, you know, take CCWD and and you know, current OUS Chancellor's Office and OSAC, and you know, they're just, you know, I think all of us could sit down and come out up with the most brilliant plan in the world that would fall on its face, because there's reality out there. And so bringing people together to, you know, to help advise us with that, that's going to be going on, and I hope to have that work group set up by early next week.
That brilliant idea wouldn't include the current situation, however.
You've got a point. At the same time, we as a committee, you know, as I've told you, we'll be devoting all of our Fridays to exploring different facets of this governance conundrum and, you know, the outstanding issues, you know, that are there that we need to get resolved. And I'll be encouraging a lot of public testimony on those issues because, as Rep. Johnson said, we have to do this in a very open and deliberative manner to get it right. Fortunately, you know, we meet 3 days a week, and we have the bandwidth, I think, to address this, and the people of Oregon deserve no less. So with that, any questions or comments about what we're looking at here? Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really feel I need some more background. The report you gave us, there's more detail than that, the three pages you gave us this morning. Is that correct?
Gave me this.
There is a bill.
That's it. But
there is a bill. It's a couple hundred pages, if you're honest.
Okay.
But your report was this.
Correct.
Was this.
Okay. The report is, it's more than three pages, isn't it?
No, those were
the Those are the recommendations from the committee.
Yes. They were accompanied by the LC.
And they were accompanied by the legislative concept at the time. Yeah.
Oh, I appreciate you or the committee staff giving me more background.
Certainly, we'll be very happy to. You know, I neglected to mention that one of the benefits of, one of the things that really helped us to get through that long process this summer was that Victoria was assigned to be the administrator for that effort. And so we're really fortunate to have her expertise and not only her ability to keep us on task, but, you know, her growing expertise in this issue. So thank you. Any other questions before we adjourn, colleagues? Okay, thank you. So with that, I'm going to close this public hearing on 2149. I assure you it will not be the last. And with that, colleagues, we are adjourned.